Hello, dear listener, and welcome to Quite a Good Sport, the show that brings you the quite interesting side of sports with me, Anna Tyshinsky, and this other person.
Hello, I'm the other person in this podcast, and my name is James Harkin.
Yes, and today, what will we be doing today, James?
Well, today we're going to be talking about table tennis. I'll be speaking to a British umpire at the upcoming Olympics, Nico Caltabiano.
Yes, and I will be speaking to British table tennis Olympian Liam Pitchford, seeing what they have to tell us about the world of table tennis.
Indeed. And then we will be going to Soho Square in the middle of London's theatre district, and we will be playing each other in the biggest drama that particular district of London has ever seen.
So stick around to find out who wins out of me and James. But first of all, a few things that we love about table tennis.
Do you know the difference between table tennis and ping pong?
No. Oh, I do know that I think the table tennis player that I spoke to for this told me to call it table tennis and not ping pong. But why? Go on.
Yeah, so when we were kids, ping pong was you had to kind of hit the ball on your side before their side, you know, like you do with a serve.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, the truth is that the phrase ping pong is a trademark belonging to Jacques and Son in the UK and Parker Brothers in the US. And so it's only ping pong if you're using their particular kit. Anything else is sparkling table tennis.
And they do send envoys to every single amateur table tennis club around the country, don't they? And the moment they overhear someone call it ping pong, they will charge you on the spot for misuse of that trademark. So you do have to be quite careful. It actually has another famous name, made famous by Boris Johnson, who you may remember as former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who called it whiff-waff.
That's right.
Right? I think it was during the Chinese Olympics, and he was talking about great sports that Britain had invented, and he referred to the game of whiff-waff. I think that could have been it. And I think that was also because there was a trademark, so other companies had to come up with alternative names, and so whiff-waff was one of them.
Yeah, we're pretty sure Boris Johnson got it off us, the whiff-waff fact, either from seeing it on QI or possibly reading it in an article written by former QI elf and good friend of mine, Justin Gaynor. We think that's where he got it from. And he got it slightly wrong, Boris Johnson, because he said that it was originally called whiff-waff table tennis, when, like you say, it was kind of, it was another trademark at the same time as ping pong.
So sorry, you're sure that Boris Johnson said something which was not 100% factually accurate?
I couldn't possibly say that about our future Prime Minister.
But yeah, wasn't it originally called Gossamer?
Gossamer, that's what Jacques and Son say.
Okay.
So this company reckons table tennis was invented by a guy called James Devonshire in 1885. And there definitely is a patent by him for table tennis. But no one can find any evidence that it was actually made. So there's no advertisements in newspapers for this game. There's no extant nets, extant bats. Mm-hmm. It seems like he might have just written it down as a patent and then no one actually played it.
Okay, I think that still counts, doesn't it? If you wrote it down as a patent?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess. What it doesn't mean is that everyone was playing table tennis in the 1880s.
No. I'm just kind of reeling from the fact that you just said patent as opposed to patent, which I feel like you're a real stickler for. Isn't it you that insists on always saying patent?
I don't think it is me. If it is, then that me is gone in the past.
He's dead.
Because at the moment, I only say patent. So I think perhaps, I don't know. How are you supposed to say it?
I thought you were meant to say it patent. But I mean, this actually could be a myth. This is from memory. And I've really remembered you getting furious when people said patent in the past. But it must be someone else.
That does sound like me, in fairness.
It really does. Actually, today I used the word electrified to mean give someone been given an electric shock, because you are so insistent that you never use the word electrocuted unless someone dies, because technically that's the definition. And it just sounds stupid if you say she'll get electrified by that wire. People just go, do you mean electrocuted? And then you have to have this long, incredibly tedious conversation going, no, I know my colleague James has this thing where it officially is.
Yeah, but look, you only have to have that conversation once and they'll remember it. Like, I had that conversation with you once and you passed it on to 10 more people, and they'll pass it on to 10 more people, and hopefully in the end everyone will say it right.
Oh my god, it's like a pyramid scheme. It's like a horrible pyramid scheme of tedious facts. Anyway, sorry, to bring us back.
Well, welcome back, dear listener. Back to the invention of table tennis. The earliest surviving game of table tennis that we have. So this isn't the Devonshire one. It's from 5 years later in 1890. And this was a It was like a lawn tennis game for the table. You had a rubber ball, a wooden net, and also there was a wooden fence that you set up all the way around the table so that, don't you think it'd be easier? It'd be like, you know, when you go 10-pin bowling and you put the barriers up.
Hang on, are you allowed to use that fence like a squash court bouncing off the walls?
I think maybe. I wonder if it's like, you know, in real tennis, like not real, you know, ironically, there's another kind of tennis called real tennis that isn't really real tennis. It's like old style tennis.
It's fake tennis, yeah.
Fake tennis. But that one had walls on the side, didn't it? That you could kind of hit it up and it bounced off. I wonder if it was like that.
It did. I've actually played real tennis, which is called real because it was royal tennis, wasn't it? And it's the tennis that people like Henry VIII played. And their courts are beautiful. I've got a friend who is incredibly good. And I think Oxford used to have one of the only proper real tennis courts. So I played there because it's where I'm from. But yeah, okay, so it's like that. But it also saves the most annoying thing about table tennis, which is honestly the reason, the only reason why I didn't turn professional, in fact, is that you have to pick up the bloody ball all the time.
Yeah.
It's a real pain.
It is a real pain.
And it goes a long way.
It goes a long way, especially when you're playing in the middle of central London and there's a load of, let's say, spectators, and you always have to kind of dig underneath the park bench that they're sitting on to get your ball.
Yeah, and they didn't show any inclination to help, actually. Just sort of sit there and laugh at us. Anyway, just one more thing on the history of table tennis. Can I quickly mention Ivor Montagu?
Yeah.
The grandfather of table tennis, he gets called by people who are into table tennis. And he's just such a great character. So he founded the English Table Tennis Federation in 1922 and then went on to found the international one and helped in making table tennis the global sensation it is today. But he was also a spy. And we found out he was a spy in the 60s, but people suspected long before that because he was basically writing letters during World War II to these two Bulgarians, obsessively analysing different bits of table tennis, the rules, the balls, the tables. And eventually MI6 wrote to the Secret Service in Sofia and said, look, we really think these Bulgarians in your country are agents because they're writing interminably to this guy Ivor Montagu here. And the letter they wrote said, even in England, which is not noted for sanity in this respect, we find it hard to believe that a gentleman can spend weeks upon weeks testing tennis balls. And it turned out that was all they were doing, we think. They got the reply saying, these two guys are just solid individuals who spend their time testing table tennis balls.
Really?
That's all there is to it.
Do we know if they were like testing different materials or...
I don't know.
I don't know, different sizes? Because they did change the size a few years ago to make it... Actually, quite a few years ago now, to make it better on television.
Yeah, was that in 2000? They changed the size, they made it bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they go super fast, table tennis balls. Even if you're rank amateurs like you and I, you can still hit them pretty fast, can't you?
Yeah, it's the only thing you can do. Yeah, it won't hit the table or get anywhere near being a point, but it will go fast.
And they also shortened it because it used to be that you played first to 21. When I was a kid, you played first to 21 all the time. But then they changed it about 20 years ago and made it first to 11.
Is that why? I did wonder why we were playing first to 11. And I just thought we must be playing a more amateur version of the game.
No, if anything, we were playing a professional version.
Yeah. How weird that the immature amateur game that I still play with friends in pubs is the longer version.
Absolutely. I don't know if they changed any other rules for table tennis, but I do know a man who would know such a thing. And that is Nico Coltabiano, who I spoke to earlier this week. Nico is a Brazilian-born British umpire who will be taking part in the Paris Olympics in a couple of weeks' time. I've got to say, the audio of this interview is not perfect, so apologies for that. But he is such an interesting guy and had so much to say that we still wanted to include some of that interview in this show. So apologies for that. But I really hope you enjoyed this interview with Nico Coltabiano. Okay, I'm joined by Nico Coltabiano, who is one of the table tennis umpires at the upcoming Paris Olympics. Thank you so much for joining us, Nico.
Well, thanks for having me, James. It's nice to talk about the experience I will have in the Olympics.
So who won? No, I won't ask you that. We are recording this a couple of weeks before the games, of course. So what does the next few weeks look like for you? Will they put you up in a nice hotel in Paris?
Well, I guess the next few weeks will be my daily work. And then I have to be in Paris a few days before the games start. I don't know if it's going to be a good hotel. I hope so, because it makes a difference.
Of course. Well, you need to be rested and relaxed because presumably umpiring table tennis, to me, it seems like it's almost impossible. Like even just seeing the ball is going to be difficult.
Well, I think it comes with experience in seeing the movements of the players. And of course, at the highest level of table tennis, I can guarantee you everything is really, really fast.
So you're sat in your seat. You got the best seat in the whole stadium. Right, the whole arena. What are you looking out for as a referee, an umpire?
As an umpire, I think there are many things that we have to pay attention to in the match. I mean, everything starts with a service, which is the most difficult thing for umpires because of the position where we are, because there are many different rules about the service. Then one of the most difficult things is when the ball hits either on the sides of the table or on the edge. Then it's very difficult to see. I was watching Wimbledon yesterday, counting 10 line umpires, plus Hawkeye. We don't have that in table tennis. So it is only the umpire and the assistant umpire to make those calls.
Yeah, I went to the table tennis at the 2012 London Olympics, and we were watching a German player, I think, against a Chinese player, but the umpire was British. And when they announced the umpire, they got the biggest cheer of the whole day because it was a British umpire and the British people were just so happy there was somebody involved.
Yeah, I remember I was there watching that final as well. To be fair, when there is a Chinese player, there's a big Chinese crowd. They travel the world to watch Chinese players. So it was 50-50, 50% of the crowd supporting the umpire and 50% the players.
What are you looking forward to most about the Olympics?
So being able to umpire some of the best players in the world.
Yeah.
And then, of course, usually table tennis tournaments are not well attended. So that is going to be interesting to have that crowd all the time.
Yeah, I bet. And of course, obviously, the Olympics is all about the athletes and whatever, but none of it can happen without people like yourself and other volunteers at the Olympics. From an umpire's perspective, I will be playing table tennis against my fellow podcaster Anna Tashinsky later on in this episode. Is there anything that you can, any tips that you can give me that will help me to beat her? Maybe some rules that I can bend, or
there's an umpire, someone who has to keep the rules in check. I would not give advice on how to bend those, just play fair.
Okay, I will see what happens. Nico, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck in Paris.
Thank you very much, James. I'll play for the year.
So thank you again to Nico for joining us. Apologies again for the sound quality, and apologies, of course, to Nico, who gave up a lot of his time to come and speak to us. And we unfortunately had to cut his interview down a little bit to save your ears. But best of luck to him in the Olympics. And actually really good to speak to someone a little bit behind the scenes. I think we'll try and do a little bit more of that as the show goes on. It's really awesome to speak to the actual Olympians who are going for gold and stuff like that. But obviously, these tournaments don't happen without all the people behind the scenes. For instance, I went to the Open Championship Golf the other day, and as I walked in, I saw a man with a falcon, and it was his job to walk around with his falcon, and whenever he saw any seagulls, he would take the little hat off his falcon so the falcon could see the seagulls, and then the falcon would fly off and scare them off, and then he would fly back to this guy and he would put his little hat back on. And the golf presumably couldn't happen without him.
Couldn't possibly happen. Imagine, if he wasn't there, seagulls would ruin not just golf, all sports. We wouldn't have Olympics, we wouldn't have Wimbledon, we'd have nothing. that's a good gig.
So we're going to have a game of table tennis later on, as we've already alluded to. One interesting thing that I found when I was researching table tennis for our book, A Load of Old Balls, is that it's one of the sports that has the smallest gender gap. Like the top female players, they wouldn't beat the top male players most of the time, but they would beat players who are, let's say, 30 in the world, 40 in the world, which for most sports is definitely not true. You'd have to go quite a long way down before the best female tennis player would beat a male tennis player, for instance.
That's really interesting. And I guess must be because it's not that much to do with strength, because it's small ball, small table, presumably. And yeah, it's not really about how fast you can run again, which is something where men have the advantage because it's small. So it's just about reaction times, I suppose?
It might be about reaction times. Of course, it might be just about society and whether you have role models who make young girls think that they want to get into table tennis, mm-hmm. whether if you're at school, you get encouraged to play table tennis as much if you're a girl as if you're a boy. You know, mm-hmm. there's lots of other things that go into it. But certainly, as far as all the sports are concerned, table tennis is one of the smallest gender gaps. So in 2019, there was a friendly match between the women's Chinese team and the US men's team, and the women's Chinese team won that. So,
although, let's face it, China is just kind of a million light years ahead of the rest of the world most of the time in table tennis.
They are. If you look in the world rankings at the moment, there are three people with the surname Lin in the top 20. Can you guess, a little quiz for you, what is the only other surname that has two players in the top 20?
Xi?
Nope. It is LeBron.
Are these brothers or sisters?
These are two French brothers.
Yeah. Okay.
It's Alexis LeBron and Felix LeBron, and they're 20 and 17. And a couple of years ago, they were both outside the top 750 in the world. But now Felix is number 5 in the world and Alexis is number 16 in the world.
All right. And threatening to bring down Chinese hegemony.
Yeah, maybe.
Fun. Another actually excellent table tennis player was Japanese. He was a guy called Hiroshi Sato, who was around in the 1950s. And he was responsible for a crucial change. There was an American called Marty Reisman who was playing at the time and kind of everyone said was going to win this big tournament. This Japanese guy turned up, but he had a sponge bat and out of nowhere just won. And after that, I believe everyone realised you've got to play with a sponge bat. And I think it imparts a lot more spin, doesn't it, sponge? Because it adheres to the ball a bit
more. And it's not like, because when you said sponge, I was thinking like a bath sponge. And I reckon that's just not going to go anywhere if you hit that, right?
Sponge on a stick. Rock up to table tennis tournaments and see how you go.
That's why table tennis bats are different colours, right, on each side. One side's black and one side's red. And that's because you can have very slightly different sponge on each side. So if you have like maybe more firm sponge on one side and softer sponge on the other side, then one side will give you more spin than the other. And it's not really fair for you to hit it so that the other player doesn't know that you've just flipped it over to the spinny side.
I don't know about this, that's not really fair thing. That feels like it would add another fun element of jeopardy to the game. If you've got no idea if this is spinning a hell of a lot or just a bit of a lot. You don't want everything to be predictable in life / ping pong, do you?
No, come on, guys. I also read once, you know, in non-real, real tennis, in big tennis, call yeah. it big tennis.
Adult tennis, yeah.
Grown-up tennis. If you hit the ball, you can like grunt and they can't hear the sort of spin that you're imparting on it. That's the idea behind it, right?
What, the idea of grunting in adult tennis?
I think so.
Is it so you can't hear exactly how spinny it is?
I think you can't hear how the ball's coming off the racket, so it kind of hides certain shots.
Wow, I thought grunting was really just kind of an unintentional ejaculation of stress and tension and effort. But no, it's all strategic. I'm judging Sharapova completely differently now.
Excellent use of the word ejaculation, by the way, in the like old 19th century meaning of shouting something out. Which I don't think has been used for at least 100 years, but I'm wrong for bringing it back.
Oh, come on.
By the way, it's not Sharapova, it's Sharapova. So if you just tell 10 people how to pronounce that and they can tell 10 more people, then that'd be great.
Oh, God, we've just lost 10 to the power 10 more listeners with you saying that. What were we saying? Shouting.
Yeah, going back to the shouting and grunting. I remember reading once that when you hit the ball in table tennis, again, they can tell by the sound of it what it's going to do. And so people would kind of squeak their trainers on the floor, you know, like in the sports hall where it's played.
Wow. That sounds like a recipe for a broken ankle. We know something interesting about table tennis balls, a trick with table tennis balls, which I think might be the only thing we say in this podcast that will be genuinely useful in your day-to-day life. You know when you're playing sometimes and it gets dented and you've only got one ball?
That's so annoying.
Can't play anymore. Do you know how you can fix that?
Go to the pub and play pool.
The pool balls never get dented, in their defence. If you heat up the ping pong ball with a hairdryer, you'll increase the pressure on the inside and the walls pop out again. How clever is that?
Oh, that is useful.
As long as they're not the old celluloid balls, because they used to be made of celluloid, which is extremely flammable, so it might burst into flame in that instance. So check first.
One thing that we really need to learn, before we go out onto the ping pong table later today, is that there are ping pong related injuries. These are ping pong patches. Apparently, people were getting hit by ping pong balls and small marks like bruises arrive on their skin.
Arrive on their skin.
Yeah.
How did that love bite arrive on your neck, young madam?
Apparently, warm compresses for 5 to 10 minutes, 2 to 3 times a day, and loose fitting clothing may dampen the force of the ball. So if you're ever playing table tennis, use some loose fitting clothing and that will hopefully save you from your ping pong patches.
Right, sure. I haven't noticed professional ping pong players in the Olympics floating around in their billowing dresses, I have to say. And you know what? I'm sad I didn't pass on that hot tip to the professional table tennis player that I spoke to, Liam Pitchford. I had a brilliant interview with Liam where I tried to pick up all the tips I could about how to play a great game of table tennis. Let's listen to that now. I have with me today Liam Pitchford, who is a table tennis player, not only a table tennis player, but the best one in Britain. Let's face it. Hi, Liam. Thank you so much for joining me.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, table tennis. Can you just tell me, because table tennis isn't one of those things that you have to do in school. It's not your football. It's not your tennis. How did you end up becoming, from a very young age, I read, becoming so very into it?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty much by accident, really. I used to play tennis when I was young and football. I used to go out at lunchtime, play football and whatever, and have a break. It was raining. And they had a table tennis club. And I just went along with two of my friends and started playing and just fell in love with it, really.
Right, here's something I always wonder as someone who doesn't know much about the sport. It does seem extremely reactive. The balls are travelling, I think they can go at 60 miles an hour. So you've got these balls racing towards you. You're incredibly close to each other. It seems like it must be so reactive. It's hard to imagine that you'd be able to really have a strategy that you implemented rather than just lunging desperately to get this ball that's flying at you. But presumably you do. So how would you describe your own style of play?
I think my style of play is very offensive. I take the ball quite early, try and put the opponent on the back foot. Mm-hmm. Probably sometimes a little bit too risky. I like to play with a lot of risk and players don't really know which way I'm going to play the ball. I've got quite flexible wrists, so it's quite hard to see where I'm playing the ball.
Sounds like what you want. And do you find, out of interest, that different, is there a difference in nationalities and how they would play? We sort of looked at this in our book with football and how different parts of the world have slightly different approaches. But I know you've spent some time playing in Japan, I think, haven't you? But do you find there's a difference in style of play between countries?
Yeah, there is for sure. I think a lot of the Asian players tend to be a bit quicker, whereas European players tend to take a step back from the table and try and play bigger shots with a bit more power. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the game's changed a lot, really, even in the last 10, 15 years. They used to make balls with celluloid, so there was a lot more spin before.
Because I think you were playing in that crossover, weren't you? Was it noticeable? Could you really tell?
You can tell, yeah. There's definitely a lot less spin in the ball, but you just get used to it, really. It's I think they did it to try and increase the amount of rallies and the spectacle for the spectators.
I think it's really interesting, the idea that a sport has to be sculpted not just for the people who play it, but for the people who watch it. Because, you know, you wouldn't have a job if it weren't for the fact that people wanted to see it happen, I suppose. So if someone is watching it for the first time, you're sitting with your friend, you want to sound like a bit of a pro, like you know what you're talking about. What kind of thing are you looking out for that looks really good?
You probably look at movement as one of them. And then other than that, like sort of the arc on the ball, when people are spinning it, you can see the ball sort of curl away in one direction or the other. And once you get into it, it's quite fascinating. You know, the spin, different spins that you can put on the ball and stuff.
And then, of course, the time when you're playing as someone who's a non-pro and it goes off at a really unexpected angle is when you hit the edge of the table. When that happens, do you do an apology when you hit the edge?
Yeah, most of the time. I mean, if you want to get in someone's head, you probably don't apologise and they'll get a bit angry. But you know, it's part and parcel of the game, really, isn't it?
It sure is, yeah. Do you try a bit of psychological tactics? I mean, it must be part of it, like it is in any sport.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time I'm trying to focus on my game and how I want to play, but there are definitely certain players that will play that game.
Okay, what would be a trying to get in your head sort of a move?
Just you'll celebrate unforced errors or cheap points, and you know, you won't say sorry on a net or an edge.
Well, whatever wins it in the end. So we've been talking a lot about how different conditions can affect things. Like, we talked to some rowers, and obviously in rowing you can see that the atmosphere makes a huge difference, the wind and the fact that the water's full of sewage and things like that. But in table tennis, I did read someone say that some venues require longer training periods in a specific location to adapt. It's hard to see how it could, because it looks like it's all basically in a gym hall. But do you find it differs from place to place?
Yeah, it does. It's actually quite dramatic. You wouldn't think so. If you're in a smaller hall, the game will be faster. The hall will be faster. The ball will be going, moving faster. If you're in a bigger hall, it'll be quite slow. Different bounces. Yeah, you have to get used to different timings and stuff.
Do you understand the science behind that bit, or do you just used to it? Because I don't even understand why that would even do that.
Not really.
You just know it's the case. Big hall feels slower.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah.
Wow. And will you know? You know, like in cricket or something. You know, you're going to India. Their pitches are always the same, and they're always going to confuse the hell out of anyone else. But in table tennis, you would have thought the tables, they must alternate them quite a lot. Will you know if you're going to a certain country or you're playing a certain team that they've got these tables? Or is it only when you get there, you'll be like, oh no, this table's soft as a bouncy castle. What are we going to do?
No, you will know before. The problem is we tend to go from tournament to tournament. So week to week to week, it'll be different. So one week you're playing on a sticky table, it's stopping. The next week you'll be playing on a slippy table. The timing's a little bit different.
How interesting. And do you know if you've got a sticky table or a smooth table coming up in Paris?
They're stickier tables. They'll stop a little bit. So we're practicing on them. We should be used to it.
Before I let you go, can I just ask? So me and James are going to attempt to play a game of table tennis against each other. And do you have any tips as people who have only ever played it, you know, in pubs after a few pints? Do you have any tips for me as to how I might go about beating James? A secret weapon I could pull out of the bag?
Try and get a bit more spin on your first serve. Just however means possible, just throw it in. Throw the serve in, and then if it pops up, just whack it.
Brilliant. Okay, big spinny serve, then just full on attack. Hit it the moment it bounces off the table.
Yeah.
Okay.
If it doesn't work, don't blame me.
Oh, I will be. I'll be calling you up absolutely furious. if you weren't playing table tennis, what Olympic sport would you be playing, do you think?
Golf. Obviously, now it's in the Olympics. I love golf.
Do you?
Yeah.
No, James has literally come on camera just for that.
Yeah.
James is a huge golf fan. So is that you play that in your spare time?
Yeah, when I get the chance. I'm hoping to meet the guys in the village if they're in. Tommy Fleetwood and
oh really? Is there interaction in the Olympic Village? You know, do you get to meet the other competitors?
Yeah, we all stay in the, you know, it's one block, Team GB block. It's great atmosphere. It's really fun being part of Team GB. Makes you feel like one big family.
Really?
Yeah,
that's excellent. I want to know if there are different personalities associated with different sports, or you know, what's your classic table tennis player?
I want to say fairly sort of humble and quiet. We're not the loudest in the village, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can see that. Who is the loudest in the village?
Probably say the boxers. You know when they're in the vicinity for sure.
I suppose that figures. Good to know. All right, well, Liam, thank you so much for chatting to me. That was really interesting and really fun. And best of luck. We'll definitely be following you, watching avidly. Really good luck.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Liam Pitchford for that interview. And I know we will be rooting for him at the Olympics. Good luck to him. Make sure to tune in, see how he does.
Absolutely. But we expect probably that China's going to win, right?
I think in almost every area of life these days, yes. But in table tennis, that's certainly among those areas.
And I think for our final story of the day about table tennis, we should talk about the amazing story of when Chinese and American diplomacy was helped by the humble game of ping pong.
Yes, I think I would go as far as to say that ping pong / table tennis has saved more lives than any other sport based on this.
Oh,
could be a bit cool. But it is extraordinary if you don't know about it. It's known as ping pong diplomacy. And we're in the 1970s. China and the US, have not spoken, have been having a mutual strop since 1949, since the Communist Revolution in China. And there's a big table tennis tournament in Japan. Now, China is very good at table tennis, wants to send a contingent to this World Table Tennis Championship. And so they do. They send their team, and America sent a team. Chinese team is under strict instructions. Do not talk to the Americans. We hate them. We're anti them. Okay? Silence. However, Glenn Cowan, who was one of the best American table tennis players, if not the best, he missed his team's bus back to the changing rooms at one point. So he had to get on another bus, and he accidentally boarded a bus that was carrying all the Chinese competitors. And there ensued this extraordinary moment where he sat down on the bus, and for 10 minutes, none of the Chinese table tennis players dared to speak to him because they all knew this is our enemy. And then the best player, a guy called Zhuang Zedong, he got up, he went over to Glenn, and he offered him a gift, which was a silkscreen picture of some mountains. And he said there did happen to be a translator there, but, you know, let's not ask questions.
And cameramen?
There were quite a large number of photographers as well. There have been questions asked about whether this was a setup, but I don't think it was. We'll never know. And he said via the translator, although the US government is unfriendly to China, the American people are friends of the Chinese, and I give you this to mark out that friendship. And Glenn Cowan, in return, rifled through his bag at the time, and I think all he had was a comb. So he said, I can't give you my used comb. But the next day, he gave him a T-shirt, I think, with some Beatles lyrics on it. And this was an absolute watershed moment.
Yeah, it was, because, I mean, I can understand why they didn't say anything for the first 10 minutes, because Chairman Mao was very anti-American, and you can imagine if they came across as pro-American, they would be in for it. They were told, apparently, just before the competition, regard a ping pong ball as the head of your capitalist enemy, hit it with your socialist bat, and you will have won a point for the fatherland. I think there's no doubt what he was saying there. But Mao saw this event, as you describe it, on the bus, and he decided that he was going to invite the American team to China to play the Chinese team, which was obviously a huge deal because no Americans had been invited to China before that. He reportedly said to his nurse, let's get it sorted, let's send the invites out. But he had just taken some sleeping pills, and his nurse was under strict orders that whenever he said anything after his sleeping pills, she was to completely discount it. Because apparently these sleeping pills made him soft and made him do things that were unbecoming to the fatherland. But anyway, so he was like, no, no, you need to do it. You need to do it. She's like, oh, I'm not really sure, because you did have those sleeping pills. And apparently he deliberately kept himself awake until she sent the invites and come back and said, yeah, I've sent the invites.
I see. And that does show true grit, being able to defeat the sleeping pill. Although I really thought you were going to say that he'd just taken these sleeping pills. And so he said to his nurse, 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 I've got an incredibly important thing to tell you. Get out your pen and paper, please. Okay, extremely important, biggest thing I'll ever say. You need to invite to China right now. You know, and you're imagining the nurse shaking him awake. What are you trying to say? But that didn't happen. And he did, and they came, didn't they?
Yeah, they came, and the West and China have forever stayed best of buddies.
Yeah, no, it was an incredible moment. Actually, I find one thing particularly incredible about it in a very narcissistic way, which is that they were playing this tournament in Japan, and it was only when I was reminding myself of this story today, I remembered that the timescale was the moment that bus interaction happened, word got back to Mao in China. He said, let's invite them. And they went straight there. Now, I am someone who will agonize for 3 months over whether to buy some foam earplugs or whether they're just a waste of
50p. Oh, my God, Anna. I've been to restaurants with you so often. And it's like, literally, everyone else has to order. I can't order before everyone else. I have to be the last person.
I know.
And then someone takes your order, and then the number of times I've seen you running across the restaurant to get the waiter going, no, I've changed my mind. I'll have the fish.
Imagine if I was leading a country, James, and be grateful that I'm just doing a humble podcast. Yeah, so I would not have had the success that Mao had in saying, hey, guys, do you want to come here for table tennis now? And they immediately went, hopped on a plane from Japan And the reason I think this saved, well, it saved a lot of lives because that stimulated this huge thought in relations. You know, the Chinese team then went to America, and then Nixon had his very famous visit the next year to China, sort of off the back of this thawing, which was essential, and which also meant there was a lot of exchanging of technology. China imported a lot of agricultural technology, which I believe saved, I would say, many hundreds of thousands of lives, probably in China, because they were suffering from some serious famine issues at the time. But an amazing moment in sporting history.
Absolutely. Another thing, of course, that saved lots of lives was the fall of Mao Zedong, eventually.
That was easy to do, yep.
But that wasn't great news for Zhuang Zedong, because he was a favourite of Chairman Mao and also of Madame Mao. And when the Cultural Revolution ended, he was arrested and investigated as being part of the establishment. But eventually the investigation ended and he became a coach of like a local table tennis team.
Really nice. And I actually read an interview with him, which was soon before he died, which was in the early 2000s. And he said his biggest regret in life was not contacting or speaking to or seeing Glenn Cowan again, which is so lovely that he held that moment, such a precious moment, pivotal moment in his own life.
It is amazing. And I suppose it really harks back to our own game of table tennis that we had in Soho Square a few weeks ago, because I won't give away who won, but the loser has just about agreed to start speaking again with the winner.
So, to listen to that other globally, historically seismic event, listen now. So, we have come to Soho Square and we're about to have an epic game of table tennis. How are you feeling, James?
I'm feeling wet because it's raining.
That's true, yes.
I also look at our pitch and I think it's a bit on the damp side.
I don't even know if we're calling it a pitch. But yeah, it's certainly damp. Yeah, what's that going to do? Enhance the game?
It could only make things better.
I think so. They usually wet the tables before they play, don't they?
I'm sure they do. Do you want the shallow end or the deep end of this table?
I don't know, as long as I'm wearing armbands.
Before we start, sorry, I've printed out the official rules of table tennis, because we have to play by the official rules, right?
Right, yeah, I just didn't need to print them out, but yeah.
The upper surface of the table should be rectangular.
Okay.
That works. Yeah, okay. It should be 2.74 metres long and 1.52 metres wide. Now, I brought my tape measure.
Great.
I also measured the height and it's 75.5 centimetres above the floor. It's supposed to be 76. This could affect my game a little bit, but that's fine.
I can adapt.
And the final thing, which is really important, is that the ball, if you drop it from 30 centimetres, it needs to bounce 23 centimetres off the table.
All right.
So I've got my tape measure. Why don't you drop it there? Oh, dear. That was more like 16, would you say?
Yeah, I would say.
Okay, well, it's not ideal conditions.
But that means we can really exploit our backspin. So we're going to play each other. We're going to try and remember everything we've been told.
Oh, dear. Sorry, Anna. I forgot to tell you, according to the official rules, the ball has to rest freely on the open palm of the server's stationary free hand.
God damn it.
And you were actually holding it, like pinching it. So I actually win that first point.
Okay, let's see what happens now.
Oh dear, sorry, Anna. I'm so sorry, you did have to throw it in the air, but what you didn't realise, it has to rise at least 16 centimetres after leaving the palm of the free hand.
Who in the Olympics is there holding a tape measure measuring that?
I'm sorry, I've been speaking to the official umpire, so I do have to know the rules. And also, that was a really good serve. It went right in the corner, but it did hit my tape measure.
What do you get for that?
Okay, so what tips did Liam give you when you were talking to him before?
He said he'd been playing since he was about 8. So I think go back in time and begin then. Crucial serve info was spin it.
Spin it.
Spin the serve for dear life.
Okay.
So that's what I'm going to do now. It's poised here.
Got it.
I'm going to slide my bat right down it.
Oh my God.
I actually, I'm astonished to say I think that might have worked.
Okay, so what's the score?
I think it's a 9-all.
9-all. And it's my second serve.
Okay.
It's now 10-9 to me. 9-10. Match point.
9-10, my serve. Okay, match. Match point. Let's get that slice back. Oh, yes!
Oh, my God.
And she's ahead. She's torn ahead.
It's this serving that's doing it. The crowd are going wild in the background.
yep.
The one man getting wet on a bench is applauding. Match point to Anna again. Oh my God. This is too much.
It's unbelievable. The angles they're getting.
It's going, you know, oh my God.
The height, the depth, the spin.
Oh no. He's missed his shot. He's hit it into the net. And he's lost the game.
He's done it. The ultimate victory.
I can only say that you having the shallow end made such a big difference there.
It does, because when you can touch the bottom, it really does help with table tennis. And that's what we've learned. Well played, James. Well played.
Well played, Anna. Well, congratulations, Anna. You are now two up in the series. And I got to say, it was a well-deserved. It was a very tight game. I'm not sure whether the 1 centimetre difference in the table made much of a difference, but definitely the torrential rain did not help my game.
A bad sportsman blames the weather.
And I'm not sure I had the right kind of sponge on my bat. And of course, I was expecting to play in a tiny room where the ball would go super fast, but obviously we were outside, which is the biggest room of all. And there was no way I was prepared for the pedestrian speed of the ball.
It's definitely true. It's definitely true, James. And may I say, you are a very graceful loser.
Well, you know what they say about graceful losers is, at the end of the day, they are losers.
Yes, which I think we've always known about you, so I don't know why we're doing this whole rigmarole to prove it. But look, thanks for a great game. Really enjoyed that. And we'll be back again next week to take each other on again in another sporting competition, although I don't know if there's much point. But what are we doing next week?
Next week, I think we're going to go down to the Herne Hill Velodrome and we're going to have a show all about cycling and seeing which of us get round there the quickest, if indeed we both manage to stay upright the whole way.
Yes, if you want to hear us at the Velodrome, and more importantly, if you want to hear us next week speaking to some real heroes of the cycling world and revealing some of our own cycling facts, stay tuned.
But until then, I have been James Harkin.
I have been Anna Dushinsky, and you've been listening to Quite a Good Sport. Quite a Good Sport was presented by James Harkin and Anna Tushinsky, with contributions from Nico Caltabiano and Liam Pitchford. It was produced by Molly Windust and James Harkin. The production team included Alex Bell, Adrian Bradley, Tara Durrell, Liying Lee, and Natasha McQueen. Thanks go to Team GB. This has been a quite interesting podcast.